This is Mia Faroletto, publisher of New Observations magazine. Welcome to New Observations. Today we are very fortunate to have Dennis O'Neill joining us, and he has a very unique story, I believe. It's not often these days that we hear of people out in the secular world deciding to leave behind an established life and go off to a Buddhist monastery for their spiritual development. And we are very fortunate to be able to have this conversation with Dennis. Hello, Dennis. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Mia. Thank you.
So tell us about your life in Chicago before you went to the monastery in Virginia and decided on a complete 180-degree change in everything, really, in every aspect of your life.
Yeah, it was a big decision, and it took me a long time to make the decision to venture out to a monastery in the mountains. I was actually born in South Bend, Indiana. My father was a graduate student at Notre Dame, pursuing a master's and his PhD in electrical engineering. And I come from a family background that's quite spiritual. One of my mother's aunts left her home at about 21 years of age in 1930 or 31. She learned Mandarin. She was a Catholic nun. She went to China and was in China from about 1931 until 1946. She built a girls, helped open a girls' school, taught music and other subjects, and was actually put in a Japanese POW camp. So she was in China for one of the more interesting periods of Chinese history, actually. The Japanese had invaded, and of course you had Mao and Chiang Kai-shek fighting. She kept a record. She wrote a sort of a memoir of her time there, which I've read twice. And I come from sort of a family of activists. My great-grandfather from Ireland, who I'm named after, Dennis O'Neill, was a union organizer in Chicago. He was an electrician. He was one of the founding members of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Union, Local 134 in Chicago, and he was murdered in the 1920s when he was organizing the infamous Armour meatpacking plant on Chicago's South Side. That was, of course, made famous in the jungle, or notorious, I should say, by Upton Sinclair. And, he was, a pretty bright man. He owned two homes, and he was in his 50s. He was a hard worker and was organizing the plant, had worked for the plant his whole career, and was killed. That's, an interesting aspect of our history that many people don't know. So I would say that I probably come from a background with some spiritual and altruistic seeking and activism on both sides of my family. I lived in Chicago from about 1980 onward. I moved downtown from a suburb that I had been raised in, and got involved immediately in community activism because Chicago in the 1980s was there were a lot of federal policies. I know the history of sort of the federal government's involvement in long-range policies that most people don't see, and they're subtle, and they're influenced by corporate America and essentially collaborating and most often really colluding with the government on all levels, but particularly at the federal level. And so the cities were seen as a threat to the, always as a sort of a threat to the establishment, because you had waves of immigrants coming over. So cities were sort of intentionally, the first there were the issues like with Jane Addams and other social activists tried to address of poverty and overcrowding and things. But as you got into the 50s and 60s, there was more intent on the part of the feds to corral black people into public housing. And then it was a matter of control. It wasn't really a matter of making their lives better. It was actually a matter of control. And to sort of clear out cities, you had white flight to the suburbs. It was subsidized by the auto industry. So there's all these subsidies and things that governments do to move and impact social policy. And in Chicago in the 1980s, I lived it. I got to see it. There were all sorts of problems, crumbling infrastructure. I wound up living in a neighborhood that was had been historically mostly Italian, and with one of the larger public housing developments in the city, therefore in the nation, because Chicago's were the largest and some of the earliest. And it was named after originally named after Jane Addams. It had been expanded from about 1938 when it was first opened up until the 1960s. And so I became a social activist, and I ran for political office twice, once in 1995, once in 1999. I received the endorsements of the Chicago Tribune and Sun-Times in 95, and again, of the Tribune in 1999. I ran against a real corrupt front for a Jewish-Irish mafia that controlled sort of the north side of Chicago. The Italian mafia controlled south of the Chicago River, the downtown area. There was a Jewish-Irish mafia that controlled more the near north side. And I ran against their patsy. And so it was a downtown ward. I saw all sorts of vote fraud. So all the vote fraud that was seen nationwide this time, it's been going on forever. Our elections they've been rigged for a long time. So I saw all that. I lived it. I got to see what happens when you marginalize people in public housing. And I learned this later. I never knew why I got to see the Jane Addams homes, which were about 1,000 units of really nice residential housing that had been built in the 30s, just deteriorate, go down the tubes in like a decade. There were a lot of people that worked, you know, that used to walk, and I'd see them walking to the L and to the subway and to go to work. And all of a sudden it just became uninhabitable. And it was because Reagan, I didn't know this at the time. I learned all this later as I became deeply involved in helping to reform and redevelop the public housing that was in the community in which I lived. Reagan defunded public housing. So it was this intentional, let's tear it apart. And then it really started with Jack Kemp had put together an initiative to kind of look at it. And I think Jack Kemp was actually a pretty decent guy. He was Reagan's secretary of HUD, I think, for a while. And there were problems, but a lot of them were, you know, self-created problems because they were defunding it. And of course, even in Chicago, when it was all built, it was all ripped off. There was a really sleazy, I guess you'd call him a kosher Nostra, head of the Chicago Housing Authority named Charlie Swibel. And if you look behind most wealthy people, you'll always find corruption or, taking large amounts of government money, federal money behind them. It's the rare exception that the people are self-made billionaires. It's usually through corruption and federal graft and all sorts of things like that. So I got to live that experience. I got to be deeply embedded in it. I was almost killed for some of my community activists. And that was a turning point. So in 2009, I took over a community organization and started working on the redevelopment of at one time had been about 3,000 units of public housing in Chicago called the Obla development. And I got deeply embedded. I learned all about the what was called the Hope Six program and enabling federal legislation that funded redevelopment of public housing into mixed income communities all over the country, most of which, or the bulk of which, were done in Chicago and Atlanta, because there was both cities had a lot of public housing. And it's just fascinating because the OBLA redevelopment, I mean, to show you just how bureaucratic and insane stuff at the federal level is, it's been ongoing for like, you know, like 20 years, and it's not even close to finished. It's still mostly vacant land. And it's just this, so I got to see all that. There were four poor black grade schools that that served the OBLA development at one time. They were all closed. I was on the local school council of one of them in the mid-90s, and I got to see urban education up close. And, you know, it was a disaster. The principal was a knucklehead. She didn't really care. It was depressing. It was depressing to see how what happens to marginalized communities. And then the feds come in, right, with the city, and they tear down grade schools. Now, this is all subject to what Lisa Alexander, who's a law professor, last I knew she was at University of Wisconsin-Madison, she called Gautreaux et al. Versus the Chicago Housing Authority, filed in August of 1996 by three civil rights lawyers. She calls that the Brown versus Board of Education of housing. And so I got to see that too. That was sort of these wealthy North Shore lawyers. There are a lot of people on the North Shore of Chicago that like to meddle in urban affairs. And it's not because they really care about urban people. It's usually involved with money and a lot of other things. And so the Gautreaux et al. Was just, I'm not kidding, like about a year and a half ago, settled. That legislation lasted, litigation really was in force and still being litigated from August of 1966 until just about a year and a half ago, which is really, to me, remarkable. But also all these so-called do-gooders, even though Gautreaux is built and stands on the shoulders of Brown v. Board from 1957, I think, 56 or 57, 54 maybe, which is, of course, the, you know, famous education desegregation case. They decided it would still be a good idea when we're going to, you know, so create this mixed-in community to close four poor black schools. They were all, you know, pretty bad schools, and just consolidate them into one school, not try to integrate the neighborhood in which the OBLA Chicago Housing Authority development resides is a very diverse, dynamic community. But all the planners, the lawyers, right, the civil rights lawyers, the people at the city, the Chicago Board of Education and Chicago Public Schools, the MacArthur Foundation, which funded a lot of this, all decided in their infinite do-gooder wisdom that there was nothing wrong with continuing segregated education when we're redeveloping federal public housing as a mixed-income community. And so I got deeply embedded that. Of course, I was appalled because I had lived through all the – I had witnessed all of this. You know, I watched a bunch of black people at meetings complaining about what's going on with our housing, because I was trying to help them even back in the like early 90s. We were trying to work together. And I was like, this is just – you know, it became a drug-infested, like, violent nightmare of decay. And I saw that happen. So I got involved. I got involved in education. I got the first STEM school in the city of Chicago opened under Richard M. Daley. He really loved the city, loves the city, never wanted to be anything but mayor, didn't have any other political aspirations. I developed enough of a relationship with him that I had some good access to him. So I took one of the schools that had been closed during the redevelopment and had it opened as a STEM school. And then when Rahm Emanuel, he actually opened the school, Welcome the Kids, when he was mayor. And then I did get funding I did get a line item for $70 million for a high school, but I decided to leave before I got that completed. There was a change in administration. Lori Lightfoot came in, and she's actually doesn't seem to know too much of what she's doing. She's alienating, like, everybody, her staff. She's had a lot of staff turnover, and I just saw things heading in a way that concerned me. And I had almost lost my life in 2011 based on some of the work I was doing. I was almost killed. I was put in intensive care for a day. I was hit by a car. It was an intentional hit. And I had, just before that, started a Buddhist practice and we had started meditating. And I had a lot of sort of profound realizations with my practice and that very close brush with death that just very much changed me dramatically, because I saw the depravity of people with what had been done with all this public housing and how the whole system works. And I saw that up close and very personally, and it really impacted me tremendously. You know, to give you one example of something that I saw about how people get marginalized, there was a woman who came up to me after a presentation, and she lived in part of the redevelopment of this public housing, and she was married, and she had fallen behind on her rent, but she or her husband were working and renegotiated a new lease with the management company, but still wound up getting evicted and had to move back in to her mother's house with her two daughters, or daughter and a son, I don't remember. And the daughter was really upset and, you know, really negatively impacted her life. And when she went to court, her lawyer, and I read the case, she's like, "Can you help me with this?" She gave me all the legal stuff and I read it. And like, her lawyer cited precedent. She's like, "There's a new contract. They renegotiated a new lease. You can't evict her." And they did anyway. So our court system's like really rigged. We saw it with General Flynn and his illegal prosecution. It happens every day.
We're actually about to take our first commercial break, Dennis. So hang on and we'll be back shortly.
My new book, Jesus, A New Vision, is an entirely new vision of the life of Jesus and what happened after. Among many other things, it is about why the resurrection happened and what happened to the teaching of Jesus that led to the creation of Christianity. It's an extraordinary and virtually untold story. Graham Hancock, author of Fingerprints of the Gods, says, "Whitley Strieber's take on Jesus is thought-provoking and inspiring. This is an important investigation filled with new insights. Highly recommended." Toby Johnson, author of Finding Your Own True Myth, What I Learned from Joseph Campbell, says, "Very wise and satisfying for the contemporary mind. My book does not deny the divinity of Jesus, but it looks at the power of the human mind and the human soul in a whole new way." It's available as a Kindle, as a paperback, and as an audio book on Apple Books and on Amazon.com. Listen to this sample from the audiobook. Reading the canonical Gospels with the eye of a detective reveals much that has been hidden, more or less in plain sight. For example, it is clear that Jesus intentionally goaded the Romans into killing him. I think that the reason that he did this is understandable, as I will discuss. He was also helped by a group of people who are almost invisible in the Gospels, but not quite. They must have been incredibly learned. In fact, they must have known and understood the secret of death itself, and thus how to surmount it. They were not members of any known order, such as the Essenes. So who were they? And for that matter, as he was not a deity come to earth, who was he really? Using a combination of a re-examination of his story and the application of scientific tools to, for example, study the Shroud of Turin, we can make exciting strides toward recovering the secrets that they must have known. Some of them are hidden in the Shroud, which it would now appear cannot have been a medieval forgery, as was incorrectly concluded back in 1988. As shall be seen, the evidence refuting that conclusion is strong. The implications of the resurrection event are amazing and exciting, and have something very new to say not only about Jesus, but about us. Jesus, a New Vision. Get it today.
Welcome back to the show. Rather than talk about General Flynn, I'd really like to focus on your spiritual journey and what led you to the monastery in Virginia, because it's been such a fascinating and worthwhile path, and I think it's what our audience will be most interested in hearing about, because you've come from a major city in the U.S., a very secular life, a life of activism and community organizing, and now you're living really a solitary life in many ways. I know you get together with your community at the monastery for breakfast and for evening meditation. But I'd really like us to focus on that path, that journey, and the steps that you took along the way. Certainly, your car accident, your hit and run, near-death experience had to have been a real milestone, and made you question, you know, what you were doing. How old were you when that event happened?
I was, well, let's see, it was 2011. So I was, you know, in my 50s and early 50s. That was a significant point in my life. It's odd to say that it's one of the best things that ever happened to me. But having that close a brush with death, I mean, actually all the treating doctors said, I had so many physicians say, you're so lucky to be alive. They were surprised I survived it. But, I had just started a Thai forest Buddhist tradition practice, about a year before, and had started meditating. And the first thing that happened when I started meditating was I saw how hard it is to quiet the mind, and so I kept working on it. I just kept working on seated breath meditation and then watching the mind throughout the course of the day, and it's a really intense discipline. And I have a lot of discipline, but it's the intensity of the discipline of a Buddhist practice is immense. And so I was left with, when I was hit, I was, it broke a number of bones in my skull and my jaw, and significantly damaged my left ear, where I lost some hearing in my left ear, and it's, you know, raging tinnitus from the injury. And my right ear often rings in sympathy with the left ear, so I'm left with this tinnitus and then the stuffiness in my left ear, where it always feels like I sort of have a cold, and I'm, you know, it's sometimes hard, like, and with a lot of background noise, to make out or hear everything that somebody says that I may be talking to them, so in a crowd or something. So I started, one of the first things I did was I started meditating to quiet down the tinnitus, and I realized pretty quickly that I could actually stop the tinnitus in my right ear through meditation. And then I started visualizing my left ear. I'm like, well, I know what normal is. Let me just try to feel that normal again. And nothing happened at first. And then one morning I was meditating, and I stopped meditating, and I realized my left ear actually wasn't ringing. It was the first time in years since the accident that that hadn't happened, where it wasn't ringing. I was like, oh, that's weird. I was like really happy.
Wow.
And that lasted from about 7 in the morning until 5 at night. And I'm like a real skeptic. I'm like, this can't last. You know, this won't last. I wonder how long it's going to last. And it lasted until about 5 o'clock. And since then, I've had other times where my left ear will actually, and it was damaged. The ear canal was fractured on the top and the bottom. The three little bones were pushed apart. So I have what's called conductive hearing loss. So that was like a right away a big fruit of a meditation practice. So as soon as I started reading a lot of the Thai Forest tradition writings, Dhamma writings, I sort of had this thought about, wow, I'd love to be a monk. I'd love to just live a solitary life and really pursue more of a spiritual path. And I was also left with a lot of anger because I knew the person that had sort of ordered this little hit on me. And it was kind of legacy Chicago outfit stuff. They were harassing another person. It was based on a project that we were working on that impacted him somewhat negatively financially. And he was kind of a gangster anyway, obviously. And so I was left with, for about a year after my accident, with just a seething rage. And the rage was due to not only the injury that I was left with, but it was more a cynicism about people. When I saw what people could do to other people for nothing, you know, the Buddha talks about greed, anger, and delusion infect humanity. They infect all of us. Anger, greed, and delusion are toxic, and on some level, they infect and affect all people. And the Buddhist path is one of really, I would, it's hard to explain because it's so extensive. The Pali Canon is really extensive, and it's amazing. The Buddha he never said he was a god. He said, he's a man. I'm a man, and this is what I teach. And so I started, looking at this anger that I had. And anger was both anger and cynicism. I had anger toward the person that left me with this permanent damage and almost killed me, and the person that was driving the car, because this was a separate thing. I mentioned this woman that got evicted where the judge ignored, precedent and just evicted her and, really turned her life kind of upside down. Her daughter had all these anger issues about it. And I'd like, so I sort of looked at both of those as, different sides of the same coin. I'm like, somebody tried to kill me over like a few bucks, literally. Some judge evicted some woman who had already renegotiated a lease and turned her life upside down. And I was like, wow, people really will treat each other like animals. Like we're kind of glorified, predators and of each other. And so I had to address that. And there's a practice called metta, which means, goodwill or loving kindness, where you really try to develop thoughts of goodwill towards all beings, all sentient beings. And so I worked on that, and it wasn't really working. And then I listened to a talk by a Thai Forest Ajahn who's well known. His name's Ajahn Jeff. He's the abbot of Wat Meta in San Diego, northern San Diego County. And it was a Dhamma talk of his about metta. And he said, what good does it do if to wish harm on anyone? He's like, if you wish harm on anyone and it comes true, what good does that do you? Like if it's revenge, what good does it do them? What good does it do you? There are karmic consequences for you and for them. And I'm like, hey, he's really right. Like what, you know, okay, so this guy, you know, was raised a thug. His father was a thug that had tried to have me killed. He's a thug. He was, you know, a total scammer. And so I sat down in meditation once and I really honestly felt goodwill toward him and toward the person that was driving the car. And I worked with that for, I don't know, a week or two. And the anger was just gone. It's dissipated. I feel no ill will toward these people whatsoever. And now I look at it as sort of a positive thing. It made me tough. I guess physically certainly tough, psychologically tough, and it made a profound impact. And so I just kept working on my practice, and over a period of about 8 years, just kept thinking about getting to a monastery, and I finally just made the decision that I would do that. Probably one of the best decisions I've ever made in my life.
Yeah, I can imagine it's opened the door to many profound changes, not only in your daily existence, but in the greater scheme of things in terms of your inner journey, your inner work.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's subtle. It's really subtle. I'm a very disciplined person. I studied electrical engineering, really applied to biomedicine, so bioengineering. Took a lot of hard courses, took a lot of discipline. It's not all the math and science stuff, you know. I remember in school I just had to sit there and really be disciplined to study all that stuff. It's often fairly abstract but I got good at it. There's something profoundly different about the spiritual discipline that's infinitely harder than any of the sort of discursive, philosophical questions. There's something about watching the mind and really working on your reactions to things. A lot of these reactions that we have, whether they're greed or anger or sort of deluded thinking, are sort of patterns that we develop, and that's actually, there's an intent behind it, and you don't, it's for some reason there's this thing that comes over most people where they think they're just subject to their emotions and that they're not actually creating them. Those are very intentful. They seem like they're on autopilot, but actually all the research in psychology shows that there's intent behind them. And there's a lot of actually good research on meditation as well. HeartMath is an amazing organization. It's there's three or four PhD psychologists involved, and a man named Doc Childra started in the 90s. And they've done some amazing research on meditation and the impact. What happens with the heart and the mind is that you get coherence when you meditate. And their method is really interesting. It's sort of breathing through the heart chakra, maybe 6 seconds on the in-breath, breathing out through the heart chakra, 6 seconds on the out-breath or so, and thinking thoughts of goodwill or love. And they have to be genuine. And what they've found is that field, so the heart throws off a really strong electromagnetic field that can be measured, 4 to 6 feet away from the body, actually. Much more strong field comes off the heart than the brain. But they both throw off an electromagnetic field. And what they noticed when they did research on meditators and other people is that there's this coherence that happens in the human body when people meditate, and other people will entrain to it even when they're not aware of it. So they did research, really fascinating stuff, with a young man and his dog. And so, he would do the the young man would do the breathing meditation using their technique, and the dog, they had the dog all wired, and the dog's, heartbeat and brain waves were like in train as well. They did it with a woman and her horse, and it happens with people. They have all sorts of experiments with people. And so that's sort of at the periphery. That's physical. You can see physical, but it's also, there's a spiritual aspect to it. That those electromagnetic fields and all of that, that's sort of a part of the spiritual world. And it's a very important part of it, actually.
It definitely is. And actually, I have a few things to add to this when we come back from our second and final commercial break. So we'll be right back.
When should you subscribe to unknowncountry.com? How about right now? Go to unknowncountry.com and click on the subscribe tab on the masthead. We offer subscriptions either by credit card or PayPal, either automatic renewal or annual or longer subscriptions without auto renew. Plus, it's easy to cancel if you wish. Do it right in your account.
And do we ever need you right now? And do you ever need us? The new unknowncountry.com is beautiful. It is fully functional. The whole archive is working. It's full of amazing stuff. Plus, this is the only place like it in the world. Keep it going. It's up to you. Go to unknowncountry.com. You know what you have to do. It's only a few pennies a day. It's not a big sacrifice, but it means an awful lot.
There are hundreds of charitable organizations in the world, but you have to have a sharp eye to be sure your money is going to where it's needed and not into the pockets of overpaid administrators. That's why Whitley Strieber and unknowncountry.com support the Mercy Corps. It's non-sectarian, it's lean and efficient, and it goes everywhere on earth that people are in need. When you contribute, you can be sure that most of your dollar goes right to the homeless, the starving, and the desperate. Go to Unknown Country and click on the Mercy Corps Foundation ad on the left side of your homepage. A $10 gift can put food on a child's plate and shoes on his feet. Unknown Country and Whitley Strieber receive no compensation from the Mercy Corps.
Welcome back to the show. Some of you have heard me speak about the fact that for many years I lived with a pack of 6 large dogs, all rescues, and depending on where I was at any given day spiritually and how high my vibration and frequency was, would have an enormous impact on the 6 dogs. And in fact, if I was in a very elevated state, the dogs would feng shui themselves. There were 2 red dogs, 2 black dogs, and 1 pure white and 1 black and white dog. And friends would come over and just be completely shocked because the 6 of them would be in a completely balanced color and male-female ratio in terms of how they would arrange themselves. Just absolutely extraordinary. And many times I've had the experience where if I'm in a highly elevated state, one instance is I had to get some oil added to my car, and the guy at the gas station was really angry that I was interrupting him, and he was literally scowling at me. And at the time, I had an old Audi station wagon, and I had to hold up the hood of the car in order for him to put the oil in. And without a single word passing between us, just standing next to me in a close proximity, he was actually giggling by the time the oil was in the car. So, it's fantastic that we're becoming more and more aware of how electrical our bodies are and how much we impact the world around us. It's all interconnected.
Very much so, and that's what the really good research shows. So there's another name for it now. It was called the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Lab. They put these measuring devices all over the planet that basically pick up electromagnetic radiation, sort of, I guess you would say, almost like consciousness. And they've done amazingly sophisticated studies about the collective human consciousness is very much tied to our planet. And it's with the Schumann, the Schumann
response.
Yeah, the Schumann resonance. And so the collective human consciousness is actually what frightens the cabal that runs this planet and has for millennia the most. And it's actually awakening, and it's probably related to a lot of different things. But of course, a lot of visionaries, Rudolf Steiner and many other people, foresaw 2020 as being a really important year. Edgar Cayce did, Rudolf Steiner did, and so did Gene Dixon, the astrologer. They all forecasted this time as being critical. And I don't think any of them even knew each other. They were all, you know, very, very different people in very different places.
There's an astrological pattern that is significant in all of this, and that is that we're repeating and even going beyond the aspects in the 1960s that brought in profound change with the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the ending of the war in Vietnam, and on and on and on. And beginning in around 2016, we are repeating that pattern again. And now with the actual beginning, the true beginning of the age of Aquarius, with multiple planets in the sign of Aquarius, we're feeling it even more. I mean, here
yeah,
we are.
Sure.
This is it.
Yeah, and the Bakhtun, we're at the, you know, it was the end of that Mayan calendar was really just the end of what they called the Bakhtun, which is the 12,000 year processional cycle that the Earth goes through. So, yeah, that's all. I think Ray Grassi, his presentation of a month or so ago was quite profound about what would the astrological implications, and he did it going back to what, like the 1600s. He did two large ones of maybe 800 years that were quite profound. It's available on YouTube. I would encourage people to look up Ray Grassi.
At the Theosophical Society in Wheaton, Illinois.
Yeah.
It's on their website.
And it's brilliant. I think it's probably one of the last presentations, or the most recent one that he's done. I'm not sure. It's close.
He did it in November. It's from November 2020.
And it's brilliant. I mean, you listen to it.
It is. I've heard it several times. It's amazing. The patterns that were just, you know, not consciously aware of, and we have entered a whole new realm of possibility now in terms of consciousness and the evolution of humanity.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny, like, being an engineer, because I am, and, you know, being somewhat of a quantitative person, growing up, just always thought astrology was utter nonsense, And even up until not too long ago, kind of, you know, really questioned it. But I started really researching it, you know, and I have a good, rigorous, analytical mind. And it was especially when I started listening to Ray's presentations, because he's really, really smart, and I think really spiritually attuned. And the data and the knowledge that he has is profound. And I think it was a combination of just not only his absolute brilliance, and spiritual, he is a very, I would say, enlightened person. There's like just an aspect to him that for me, it was immediately like, wow, a very much felt a connected, you know, sense of just listening to him talk. He's just an amazing person. And, but it was also all the other stuff that I've looked at, you know, the really more rigorous stuff, like the, you know, the heart math data. That's all published in, you know, reputable, really good journals. The Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research, you know, lab is, you know, has top scientists looking at this. And so any good spiritual practice, you know, meditation and quieting the mind and being moral and being loving and kind and is a benefit. It's a benefit to yourself and to others. And I think that the planet, I really do think that humanity is waking up to that. We have been so, you know, Steiner saw that materialism has its, it has its place and it has its benefits, but it is a very, very much of a double-edged sword, and you have to be careful with it. And I think people are starting to see that. I think that, you know, he probably had questions about whether or not humanity would. But my sense, and I think a lot of the sense of a lot of other people, is that people are waking up to that. You know, we've been kind of sold a lot of, ever since I was a little child, I thought I was being lied to, I felt like I was lied to in grade school. I thought all the stuff I was studying was mostly nonsense. It didn't strike me as having much to do with education. All the material things that are pushed on people to buy this and you'll be happy if you have this. I learned lessons about materialism as a child, that it was not really where fulfillment comes from. It's not where happiness comes from. But we are basically mass MK Ultra'd by literally.
Well, I think that we're easily influenced, and with television and technology and so many other things that people have turned themselves over to, it's become even more so in the last 50 to 60 years. But more than that, it's about taking responsibility, individual responsibility for our own inner lives, what we think, how the words that we speak. And going back to your accident and your anger, again for a bit, the interesting thing that people need to pay even closer attention to now as consciousness is rising is the subtle power, if you will, of their thoughts. And Ray Grassi, who was a student of Kriyananda in Chicago for many years, he started as a very young man. And the interesting thing I find about Ray is not only is he spiritually evolved and enlightened, but he's also a scholar. So he has a very highly evolved and developed library at his disposal, shall we say. But he had shared with me a story about Kriyananda, who had a spiritual center in Chicago for many years. And Kriyananda was having particular serious problems in terms of personality issues with one of the monks. And he shared this story with Ray as part of a teaching. And for 3 days, I believe it was 3 or 4 days, Kriyananda prayed for a solution. And it turned out that this particular monk fell down the stairs and broke his neck. So we have to take responsibility for the energy that we put out and the end result, and, you know, get into a place of neutrality where we're not even just subconsciously sending out our anger and hostility to not only to a person who frustrated us or caused us harm, either literally or, that's our interpretation of it. But that energy that we're emitting is influencing all kinds of people, near and far, that we're not even consciously aware of.
Yeah, and it's subtle. It's subtle, and it's also something that you as a spiritual being will, in a sense, have to answer for. That the karma is a universal law, and it just means karma or kama, just means action. It's really like, people are like, well, what's the Buddhist practice? You know, I would say it's kind of like getting a PhD in your own psychology, maybe two or three PhDs in your own psychology. And it's also, you know, learning that every action, every thought, every action has karmic consequences, and they're subtle, and or they can be more profound, but they exist, and they create causes and conditions for you as a spiritual being that are either good or bad, and you have so much more control over your life and the vision of your life that you want to realize. That's human beings are powerful, powerful creators, and we need to use that creative ability and our collective consciousness to profoundly change the way we exist together on this planet. And I think it's going to happen, because I think that as more and more people wake up, I think you will see that sort of collective resonance of our consciousness that's tied to the electromagnetic field of this planet and this solar system and the rest of the universe, actually. That we'll see profound changes. You know, Ray is not only really spiritually developed, you know, he's a musician, a photographer. I mean, he's a profoundly creative and beautiful man. He's brilliant. And,
yeah, he's an amazing individual. Amazing. And the finest astrologer I've ever come in contact with.
Yeah, so. And I think you said your next issue, I think, is going to be, is it the next issue that's going to feature some of his work?
The next issue of New Observations magazine is a monograph, actually, of Ray Grassi's photography, which I'm really excited about, and it's focusing on photos, his nighttime photographs, and we're including a couple of astrology articles that he's written, you know, obviously connected to the night sky. So it'll be coming out in about a month, and the images are really beautiful. So it'll be available online for everyone to read for free.
Wow, it's outstanding. Yeah, Mia, I had, when I heard your review of your Consciousness and Contact conference of 2019, I knew I had to find out who you were, because I was just so impressed with the work you're doing.
Who is this crazy woman?
yeah. No, it wasn't who is this crazy woman. It's like, wow, who is this, you know, really dynamic, amazing woman who's doing incredible work in consciousness and art, you know, consciousness in the arts. Since you've been really putting a lot of effort into, I guess you could say, sort of relaunching New Observations, it's amazing. The work that you're doing is incredible. And so it's definitely, your work has also, really positively impacted my spirituality as well. When I went to your Consciousness and Contact conference last year, and it was really amazing. It was amazing.
Oh, thank you, Dennis.
You're doing fantastic work, and you know a lot of really interesting people. I never would have known who Ray Grassi was. That was a contact I made through you, and I was like, wow, this guy, you know, he's an amazing man. So I really commend you for the work that you're doing. You really know how to move powerful agendas on a shoestring budget. And Mia, I've done that, and I And I have to say, I'm really, really impressed. I'm really, really impressed. But it's also, it's because you have a sense of altruism and giving, and that's, and you seem to be able to manifest things, which is a pretty high spiritual power.
Well, thank you, Dennis. It was amazing to have you in Wausau last July, and I hope you'll be there this July as well. We have an incredible group of speakers coming, and the virus is, winding down. Numbers are diminishing, so I think it'll be easier for people to travel at that time. But your experience in Wausau, I know after you went back to Virginia, after, traveling out there for the conference, and, it's highly unusual for you to leave the monastery to begin with. How do you feel the conference impacted your spiritual work? Did you notice any differences once you returned back to Virginia?
I just noticed a difference in, there was a, it's hard to describe. A lot of what you experience, spiritually is a little bit beyond words. I definitely had, I guess the only way I could say it is I just had this much more, it was just a higher resonance. There was it was like a impulse function. It's called an impulse function in engineering. It was like, wow. I was just like, got this, felt like I moved to a higher level. It's hard to describe. And I don't, there was, well, one of the things too, was you had Alana Friedland there. And so I read her, the only work of nonfiction that she's written, and it's a brilliant novel, and in four parts. And so I was able to spend a lot of time talking to her out there, which was wonderful. She's a brilliant, brilliant woman. I'm not kidding. Like, one of the highlights of my life. She's funny. She's smart. I think she's pretty spiritually evolved, and she is a phenomenal researcher. And, so I got back here and I read her four-part novel, and it's absolutely, I'm a big reader. I've been a
Sub Rosa.
Sub Rosa America. It's brilliant. It is brilliant. It is such a spiritually evolved work, and it's quite, there's some esoteric things in there. And I'm kind of, one of these days I'm going to go, were you ever initiated into a mystery school? Cause she's really, it's quite profound. I think that had a lot to do with it. I think it was that, and also just watching you do what you do. Like, there was just, the presentations I found interesting, especially Alana's, but there was just something about the experience that it was, being with you and Alana and just being a part of that and sort of observing it all and participating. And the South Dakota, there's intense spirituality to that land out there. Wow. That was the other thing. There's something, it was the first time I'd ever been there. I left here because my father, had a little bit of heart problems. So I was, and it was coincided with your conference. So it was really convenient, but, the whole experience of, and I know it was, I think that was the first one you did in Wausau, right?
It was the first one in Wausau. The year before had been on the Pine Ridge Reservation itself, in Kyle, but the reservation was closed this past summer because of the virus.
Right.
We're building an artisan residency program in Wausau, as you know. Which is very, very exciting because artists and writers who come will be able to experience the incredible land, but also experience Lakota culture and spirituality once the virus, is no longer a threat.
Yeah, that's really cool. Michael Lee Hill is a really fascinating person. He's part Native American through his mother's side, and I would say really highly spiritually evolved. Well, he's got an interesting YouTube channel, self-titled, two of them, because he's also a musician, one's for his music and one's for his, all his spiritual stuff. And so I've done some research into the Native American spirituality, and it's really profound, and all the, you know, the mound builders and all that, he's really into that because of all the experience he had up on near Cleveland. There's some really, really sophisticated, I think they're Iroquois mounds, and yeah, all the Lakota, all that. I mean, it's just fascinating. What you're doing is really profound out there with your artist in residency program. I think it will be immensely successful, but I think there's also on a sort of cultural and spiritual level, because of the Lakota, your connection to the Lakota, which is quite deep. I think that that's going to really be something spectacular on the spiritual plane as well.
Well, thank you, Dennis. I really appreciate hearing that from you. I think that our conference last July was very significant for a number of reasons. And because of the virus, I wrestled with, you know, having it or canceling it or postponing it. But my guidance told me very clearly that the conference was supposed to happen. And I believe it was supposed to happen because it was a continuation of the work that we had started the summer before. But there was something specific going on with our group, working in collaboration, I believe, with Cindy Katches, the Katches family annual Sundance that was taking place on Pine Ridge. Had the reservation been open, we probably would have been there too. We would have done that as well as the other things that we did. But we were, in a sense, doing our own purifying work as the Sundancers were over at the Katches property. And for us to have had Paula and Chief Arville Looking Horse travel 6 hours each way to come and join us for an afternoon, part of an afternoon really, was extraordinary. So we were, and then to go with Henry Red Cloud to Bear Butte and say our prayers and you know, meet on such a sacred site. There was definite spiritual work going on simultaneously with the Sundance on Pine Ridge and with what we were doing. And as you know, it was an extraordinarily hot weekend. It was well over 100 degrees. And then Sunday morning, the weather broke, and the energy cleared in Wasta, and the energy cleared on Pine Ridge at the Sundance at the same time. Like, it was fascinating, the parallels that happened between the two events. And I truly believe that we were working in tandem. And as you recall, one of our attendees, Adam Good, had to go home because his mother was sick. And he reported later that Sunday morning, back where he lives, not that far from you in Virginia, I know he's not in Virginia, but he's relatively close to where
you are. He's in West Virginia, but nearby. Right. Yeah. He's in West Virginia, but quite close. Yeah.
He felt the house shaking, and he knew that it had to do with something that was going on at the conference. And interestingly enough, a friend that I've made through Whitley's channel, who had gone out to the Rosebud Reservation, and she and I have spoken on the phone, but we communicate mostly by emails. On Sunday morning, she reported, and she lives on Long Island, that she had a really profound energetic and spiritual opening, you know, again, happening just as this energy was cleaning and clearing and expanding. So, you know, I know that we were meant to be there last summer, as hard as it was. And it was not easy. It was not an easy time, you know, for anybody, because of the heat and a number of things, but it was extraordinary. I mean, everybody, had an amazing time ultimately, whether they realized it or not when they were going through it.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's funny because the heat didn't bother me one bit, but it was hot, but, it's pretty dry. One of the more interesting things that happened was, you know, Alana's presentation, because it was quite long, and I'm, you know, well aware of all the geoengineering stuff that's been going on for a long time, but her presentation is so comprehensive, and when you sit and listen to it for 3 hours or whatever it was, it's a little disconcerting. I remember, you know, it's like, whoa, it's because it's dark. There's a lot of dark forces on this planet, and that are doing really bad things. And it's this really fascist corporate worldwide agenda. And, but the whole time I was thinking, right, but you don't have to resonate with that. And then it was on the last day. One of the attendees, Joe from Hawaii, came up, and Alana and I were talking, I think, and he came up and he said, He started talking to Alana. He said, you know, I was really kind of like, I forget how he worded this. He was like praying about it and, you know, really meditating on it. And he said, I got this message that, you know, all of that's true, all that's going on. He goes, but we don't have to resonate with it. And it doesn't really, if we don't resonate with it, it doesn't impact us. And I'm like, wow, that's fascinating that he would write like, that's that sort of collective consciousness. And it's the same thing with this virus. We don't have to resonate with this. It's really bullshit. Like the fear machine, you know, the corporate media, corporate world fear machine to keep humanity in this, you know, perpetual state of like uncertainty is not something that we should be resonating with. I don't care about the COVID virus. I don't wear a mask. I didn't wear one out there. You know, I remember went shopping in, you know, Walmart or Sam's or one of those godforsaken box stores. And everybody wearing a mask. I'm like, I'm not going to wear one. There's no masks don't do anything anyway. There's, you know, resonating with fear is just, no good comes of it. It's not necessary. So don't play into the agenda. The agenda is always a fear-driven agenda. It's this mass MK Ultra that is run on, you know, certainly in the U.S., probably worldwide.
Well, it's also, again, based on personal choice, because people choose, you know, what they're getting involved in. And you know, for me personally, the further along I go on my own path, the more I'm inclined to believe that Dolores Cannon had the right idea. And in fact, that, you know, I do believe that heaven on earth is here. And I do believe that, you know, my reality could be the complete opposite of my next door neighbor. And that I'm not impacted by the things that are going on, you know, an acre or two away, based on how I'm, you know, vibrating energetically and what my frequency is at any given moment in time. And that's the thing, you know, we have a great deal of say ultimately over what happens depending on how we live our lives.
Right, right. So there is the individual responsibility, but there is the collective is important too, though. That collective consciousness is very important. And the more that can be in sync and one of goodwill and not fear, the better off all sentient beings on this planet will be. The more we all choose to resonate together at a high frequency, and you can look your cymatics. Michael Lee Hill has done a lot of work, really interesting stuff in cymatics. You could see coherence. You could see that love and goodwill are just higher frequency vibrations than fear and anger. They're higher frequency. How that impacts the body is well documented through really good studies about what it does for, you know, your health. And so you have to choose to make your reality one of joy. And the message is the opposite. The message that the MK Ultra that's run on us is sex and, you know, this self-indulgence nonsense and idiocy and fear and materialism. And those are all really just basic low frequency, non-productive. And so I don't listen. I don't let any of that in, you know,
you're living in a monastery. I mean,
well, I didn't
really.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. But I didn't let it in Chicago either.
No, I'm not suggesting that you did. My point is you're now living in a place that it's very easy. It's a lot easier to maintain that space, that inner space, that outer space, than living in the secular world.
Right, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And there's no doubt about that. And that was, you know, it was a choice I made because...
A choice, right.
I love Chicago, but, you know, in any big city, you're assaulted with all sorts of stuff, right? You know, the field there, the collective consciousness field in a large city is going to be a lot less coherent than it is, you know, elsewhere, typically in a smaller, you know, or in nature. It doesn't have to be, but it typically is because, you know, people want to get angry over all sorts of stuff and do. And, you know, all those learned behaviors of anger, greed, and all that just leads to delusion and a really non-productive life. Like, we are here, this is a spiritual experience, and you know, there's tremendous evidence for reincarnation. The University of Virginia's Division of Perceptual Studies has collected, they probably have well over 6,000 now, rigorously documented cases from all over the world of people who remember past lives. And I mean, they are rigorously documented. They're ranked and, you know, scored on a number of different criteria, like quality of medical records, witness interviews, close witness, all sorts of, I mean, amazingly sophisticated research. There's choice. There's choice in the spiritual realm of what form the spirit takes. And right now we are embodied spirits. We are human embodied spirits. And to think that all that's available to us here is, you know, what kind of car we drive and how much money we make. If that's what you think your existence here is for, then, you know, I guess have at it, knock yourself out, but you're going to miss a lot. I think the overwhelming evidence from near-death studies is that what matters in life, really at the end when you're checking out, is how much you loved. How much were you really good to other people and, you know, good to yourself? And you know, because being loving is a two-way street. Being good to other people comes back, you know, exponentially to you.
Oh, absolutely.
You get more out of it than the other person. And that's what people, you know, people, I think, like, that's the lesson. You actually get more out of it than the other people, the recipients do, when you're good to other people.
We are meant to be of service, you know. We really are. And when we're selfish and self-centered, that's when we limit our ability to love. And one thing that you and I share is you're living in the monastery. I'm living on my modest social security. And to have that kind of financial freedom, like to not think about you know, getting the next big job or whatever, the material world, really, I cannot express my gratitude and the freedom and creativity that I've been allotted, you know, since I decided to take my Social Security early, and since I made that decision, I truly feel that I've done the most important work in my life. So it's a question of priorities and where we decide to put our energy.
Yeah, exactly. I because I didn't know I was being lied to basically ever since I was a child, my whole goal in life was one of spiritual seeking and intellectual seeking, and I never wanted to work too hard, and I didn't. You know, I'm fortunate. My family, my father's had a modest income all his life. He's a college professor, but he's put together a significant estate because he's smart, and I think he has good karma. There's a Buddhist saying about you want to know what your past lives were like, or you want to know what your future lives are going to be like, look at your present, right? There's a you know, being present and being mindful is a discipline. And when I do that, I'm like, wow, I must have had a lot of good past lives because I chose a really amazing birth. My mom and dad are really smart, giving, loving people. They're very altruistic. It was never about money with them, but they had money. And my dad always said, he's like, find out what you want to do in life and do it. He goes, the money will come. Don't worry about the money. He wanted to be a professor and do research. It's what he's done. He's done amazing research in biomedicine, is still doing it today, you know, at 80 some years old. And it was always about being of service. But that, you know, that's, I guess, just comes from me. For me, it comes from both sides of my family. My great grandfather being a union organizer, it wasn't about how much money he could make. It was about what's, you know, you're exploiting people. You know, these rich Armour family was, you know, one of the industrialist families. It's like, you know, they were basically treating the humans a little bit better than they were treating all the cows and pigs and sheep they were slaughtering for money, right? I mean, imagine the horror of the karmic horrors of what was happening there, you know, this wholesale slaughter of sentient beings, and especially back in those days, but even today. And, you know, so they basically looked at him like one of, you know, you're a sheep too, because that's how the controllers do look at humanity. The really evil people that run this world look at us as sheep. And so they treated him like one of those animals, and they slaughtered him. That's what they did. That's what these people do. And you know, the way to rebel against that is to create a new paradigm and not buy into it. And that's what will happen. You know, right now, agribusiness, the deadly agribusiness is trying to take over India. There's all sorts of protests going on. I'm like, don't let them do that, right? The Indian farmers are rebelling right now because they know what's coming. And they've done this all over the world. And we need to push back on them. This GMO, look, I'm a bioengineering. I could tell you all about the genetic code. I spent a year on my own studying quantitative genetics. I know genetics quite well. The genome stuff has a lot of unforeseen consequences, and especially when you combine it with all the highly carcinogenic things like Roundup, the Roundup Ready stuff. That shit is deadly. And so we need new paradigms, and it needs to be local, and it needs to be respectful of our environment and respectful of life and positive, because the agenda that's being driven by the corporate fascist, you know, paradigm is deadly and of just a low vibration. And we need to get past that.
Well, we are just about out of time, and I think, you know, that's a whole other show. But is there anything in closing that you'd like to share with the audience? And how can people get in touch with you if they'd like to?
I prefer not to have a lot of contact. I'm really here to not have contact with people. You know, but I'm so I'm very private. I was even reluctant to do this interview, but because I respect you so much, Mia, and the work that you're doing, I thought it would be a good idea because I think that what you do is really amazing work. But I would just say that for the people that aren't familiar with what you're doing, they should, you know, check out, I think, you know, especially when your artist in residency program really gets up and running, which I know will be pretty soon in WASDA, I think there's going to be amazing potential for people to support that. So I would encourage people to support your work. Because I think there's just a lot of really great things that are going to come out of that. I would encourage them to look at new observations and, because that's a profound, project that you're working on. So that's really all I have to say, just really to commend you for the work that you're doing. I think it's exceptional. And, you know, I know a lot of exceptional people. There are a lot of them in Chicago. But the work that you're doing and your sort of history is really, really exceptional. And I, you know, for me, it's an honor to know you.
Oh, Dennis, thank you so much. It's an honor for me to know you. And thank you very, very much for sharing this big change that you've gone through. I am jealous in a way because I've always had this dream of like going off to the monastery, and I don't know if that's ever going to happen for me, but nevertheless, I'm in the monastery in my heart. So.
Well, one of the teachings of the Buddha really is gratitude, to be grateful for what you have, no matter how little it is. And I practice gratitude here. It's like 24/7. I really almost feel like I'm living
so
in a
important.
Dream. Right. But, you know, so it's easy to practice here, right, because I'm surrounded by beautiful nature and I'm in a monastery. But, you know, so I am, you know, like eternally grateful here. But I started that practice in Chicago, too, you know, because, you know, the daily frustrations. And I'm like, just be grateful. Be grateful. The orientation of gratitude for what you have and all of the beings that have helped you become who you are. And there are many of them.
Yeah.
There are many you never think of. All the people that are being exploited to pick the vegetables that you eat and the fruit that you eat and all that stuff. There are all sorts of sentient beings that participate in supporting you on one level or another. And be grateful for them. Have gratitude and goodwill for them. That's really important because that is the frequency that you want coming off of your heart into the collective consciousness. And it does.
It's a very good point. And in fact, all of the kingdoms, as Steiner points out, all of the kingdoms are in support of humanity right now to be brave, raise our frequency, raise our consciousness, and claim our birthright.
Yep, exactly.